The Bill Myers Show podcast is sponsored by Clouser Drilling. They've been leading the way in Southern Oregon well drilling for over 50 years. Find out more about them at clouserdrilling.com.
Here's Bill Myers.
11 minutes after 6, welcome. The final show of 2024 for me. Join in the conversation if you wanted to get your Christmas greetings into the world or talk about anything else on your mind. It'll be a few days of Hugh Hewitt filling in for me, or whoever's filling in for Hugh Hewitt filling in for me, just the way it goes. But anyway, I just appreciate your listenership for this year in 2024 and beyond. It's going to be an interesting time in 2025, no doubt. State legislative session is going to be on. President Trump is back in, so we'll have better news out of Washington, maybe, than what's coming out of Oregon. But one way or another, we'll keep you up on such matters. Number here is 770-5633-770-KMED, and my email is bill@billmyershow.com. I wanted to touch on and kind of pick up again on Friday's talk. We talked a little bit about this because I ended up getting this this long email, and then it was dropped off at the radio station, and it had pictures of the supposed cameras inside three bathrooms in the city of Grants Pass. These were those Portland-style loos, those really expensive outdoor bathrooms, for the most part, you know, that kind of thing. And these are designed to be able to withstand the vandalism tendencies of the drug-addicted raving homeless. Okay, that's essentially what is going on here. And they ended up sending this stuff out to all the media members, everybody, all the television, the newspapers, what newspapers are left, etc. They all sent it out there, and they sent the pictures. And the pictures did look like inside this little steel box up in the up on the wall of the Portland-style loo, as they term them. It looked like there was a lens inside there. It did look like there was a lens of sort and an LED light. That's what the claim was. And the claim was that there were pictures being taken, or that there were cameras actually operating inside the bathroom. Well, that didn't make sense to me. On the other hand, I wouldn't think that you have a right to total privacy to do absolutely everything, whether it is shoot drugs up, have sex with whoever you felt like having sex with on the street. Who knows? There's all sorts of things that have happened in public restrooms. Nor do you have a right to flush all of your needles down the toilet too, which has been something that's happened a lot here in Southern Oregon. That seems to be what the public restrooms have been all about. And so these people that made the anonymous claim ended up sending me this stuff. And most people are saying, no, it's not a camera, that it's a sensor. Some people are saying that it turns on the blue lights inside the loos. Now, the blue lights, in fact, you'll see those blue lights all over Southern Oregon. It's kind of a growth industry to put out the blue lights. The blue light specials here in Southern Oregon are lights that make it really difficult for the addicts to shoot up. You can't see your veins. And I guess the idea is if you put the veins up, then they don't come around and congregate around your particular shopping center, your supermarket, or whatever the case. These are kind of areas that you see these blue lights. Well, apparently they have these kind of blue light, black light, ultraviolet, the kind of lights that you can see most things to function, but you can't see the veins to shoot up, because everybody knows this is where a lot of the fentanyl addicts have gone, and they'll go into a public bathroom and shoot up, and then they'll knock the sink off the wall or go to the bathroom on the floor. I mean, it's just all sorts of, it's just been a really, really rough thing. And then this paperwork comes in claiming that these are cameras, and they're breaking the law, and they're going through all this. And I ended up getting some emails about this, and they don't say who they are. The email address is 399divorceinoregon@gmail.com. It could be something which is made up, or it could be some paralegal or an attorney who is just doing this on the side. I don't think that an actual attorney would probably try to be private about it. They would probably just say, hey, we're from the law firm of Dewey, Cheatham & Howe, and stop doing this, Grants Pass. But they're asking the city of Grants Pass to stop using these cameras, what they're calling cameras, in the restroom. Well, I called the city of Grants Pass after the show on Friday, and I got in touch after going through, you know, well, the first thing, the very nice, friendly lady who answered the phone in the city of Grants Pass says, it says it's nonsense, is what she said. Apparently, they've been getting a lot of calls. And so I put a message in to Bradley Clark. I think Bradley Clark's in charge of the facilities. I forget the exact title. But Bradley ended up calling me back Friday afternoon, and he insists, absolutely insists, that those are sensors to turn the lights on and off, that they won't stay on forever. That's what Bradley said. He's the one in charge of these facilities. And that, I don't know what else to tell you at this point. Well, 399 Divorce and Paralegal, who was asking me about these things, wrote me that we do not want, authorize, or permit our opinion or information verbatim provided by name to be mentioned by name. Oh, baloney, you can't tell me that. Don't send me something if you don't want it coming in, okay? Don't tell me, you know. Yeah, I love people that wanted to tell me how what I'm allowed to say. You write a talk show host, you don't get to say no. That's not the way it works, okay? But it says, but we looked at two of the restrooms during the day and night this week, and it seems that likely the city is not being truthful. First, you will see in the video that when the door is open and a person enters the space, that no lights turn on at all. The red flashing light from a camera generally signifies the camera is recording, doesn't it? Both bathrooms we visited have a flashing red light in the camera during the day and night, but opening the door did not trigger any light to come on or off. The black lights are on full time in the evening and early evening or when dark enough, but not on during the day. We again covered and uncovered the camera lens and nothing noticeably happened. Who from the city did you speak with? Well, I just said, Bradley Clark. I'm going to tell you right now, I'm at this point where there has been so much vandalism from homeless, I don't think I care if there is a camera there, do you? There may be a law against it, but there's a law against shooting up fentanyl, too. I don't know if that... the city insists to me, for all the people who are concerned about cameras in these places, in the city of Grants Pass, in these Portland loos, file your lawsuit, I guess. File the lawsuit. I guess that's all you can do. File the lawsuit and then force the discovery and all the rest of it. Bradley ends up telling me he insists, he assures me that there are absolutely no cameras, no city cameras installed in those places. None. And as far as whether cameras would be legal or not, I would venture a guess that if you were just taking a look, headshots of people coming into the bathrooms, you could probably get away with that. There's also another possibility. Maybe they're dummy cameras. Maybe they're designed to look like cameras in order to let people think that they are being taped. And so maybe they won't flush the needles down the toilet. I don't know. But if you have proof, file your lawsuit. That's all I would say. The city of Grants Pass has been in a lot of lawsuits as of late, and in my opinion, I doubt they want to get in yet another homeless lawsuit, this time over cameras in there. Although I got to tell you, if I had a public restroom, I think that I would be putting a camera in them because you sure can't trust the public with a public restroom right now, especially given that the public that tends to use these restrooms are drunk, drug addicted, raving lunatics in some cases. Yes, I know they have a disease, but still, they're raving lunatics and they cause a lot of problems within our cities. So I guess of all the things I'm going to get excited about here in Southern Oregon, I don't know. I'm having great difficulty getting excited about the possibility of there being any cameras of sorts, of any sort, in the raving lunatic dens. All right? If I'm right about that, fine. If I'm wrong, go ahead and have at it. But, yeah, I mean, I still have the original, the original information, too. City insists that it is not a camera and that it is a sensor. And until someone can actually prove otherwise or you take it to court, I don't know what else to tell you. It's, given that the taxpayers in Grants Pass have been screwed and blued and tattooed so many times over the homeless issue in Southern Oregon, I wouldn't blame them for putting a camera. In fact, I don't know, maybe I'd just put a camera on the door as everybody comes in. Okay, we're taking a picture of every one of you as you come in, and if there's a problem with these, we're going to come and ask you questions afterwards. You want your free bathroom? Fine. You got your free $200,000 a piece stainless steel bathroom or whatever it is. But we're going to find out who you are as you go in. I'm okay with that. 770-563-3770-KMED. Yeah, and by the way, don't write me and then tell me that I can't share the information. It's like, come on. I love people that say that will write me emails and call me every name in the book. And you better not share my name. It's like I can pretty much share anything I want when you send it to me. Anyway, this is Bill. Hi, good morning. Who's this?
Hey, Bill, it's David.
David, how you doing?
Bill, I've been listening to you for so many years, man. And I'm going to tell you, I am not just going to sit by and not be a person of action and wait for someone to do something. So I just want to let you and your listeners know, I've been going around the valley for months now putting cameras in so many bathrooms, Bill. I've got dozens of them rolling right now, okay?
You're the one putting the cameras in there. You are?
Oh, yeah, Bill. Bill, it's time for people to take action. So I've got cameras in all these toilets all around the valley, okay? And I'm going to get your listeners feeds, live feeds, Bill, for the community.
You can't even do this with a straight face. You crack me up, though. You can't even joke with me with a straight face on this.
It's time for action, Bill.
David, Merry Christmas, okay? Thank you.
I'm going to miss you, Bill.
We're going to miss you too, man. Till next year. Oh, man. Hi, good morning. Who's this?
This is Miner Dave.
Hey, Dave. How you doing?
Well, first off, I want to wish everybody a nice Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And I sent you an email that I asked Gork on X a question. What is true love? Now, it wrote it. I edited it.
Oh, okay, you asked what online? What did you ask them?
What is true love?
No, what did you ask? What? I mean, who did you ask?
That's the question. What is true love?
No, I know that. Who did you ask?
Gork on X.
What is Gork on X?
It's the AI.
I stay away from X if I can help it. But anyway, please continue. Go ahead.
Well, anyways, it wrote out a beautiful thing. I edited it. I pulled things out that didn't make sense. But it gives it from the philosopher's view, the spiritual view, and I think it's really well written for AI, edited by me. And I would like you to read that email and then
Minor Dave, I did not get an email from you this weekend. I don't know if it got spammed out or what. Sorry.
Well, I'll resend it to you because I think you'll like it.
Oh, thank you.
All right.
Okay.
Anyways, I want them to understand what true love is and whether you have it or not.
Okay. All right. I appreciate the call. The other thing I wanted to ask you. Cameras in a bathroom. And it's a public bathroom. It's been vandalized again and again and again. What do you think about cameras in a bathroom if there actually were cameras in the Grants Pass one?
Well,
City insists that there's nothing going on there. All right.
Well, I understand, and I believe it's for it's either a dummy camera or because those things are, even though they're cheap, you gotta have them hooked to power, mm-hmm. and or you gotta come in and change them out, and then you have to have them streamed somewhere so that you can collect the video. Mm-hmm. But I believe that the blue lights are everywhere that I've seen there here in Canyonville.
For the longest time, I was wondering what the blue lights are about. Not being a raving drug addicted lunatic, I didn't know what those were for. So
yeah, that's actually a good one. I didn't know it until I seen the blue lights, and then I put I looked them up. Why would they use blue lights? Because it makes everything look purple.
Yeah, and apparently you can't see your blood veins or the blood vessels, or it's a lot harder to find them.
You can't see mine anyways. When I was in the hospital, they had trouble sticking me, and I don't like needles.
Don't blame you, my friend. Don't blame you. 770-5633, 770-KMED. How do we go to line four? Hi, good morning. Who's this?
This is Joe in Jacksonville.
Hello, Joe. How you doing this morning?
Hi. Oh, I have a pebble.
You do? Yeah, that's right. You won't have a pebble in your shoe Tuesday, so what's your pebble today?
Well, I read a little bit of an article in the Rogue Valley Times that Merkley and Wyden have authorized $33 million.
Yep. Yeah, and by the way, that's out of that Inflation Reduction Act. That's the loot coming out in the last few weeks.
They're putting it. If you've ever been to Canada, they have these suckers. You're riding down the freeway, and you look up, and there's this green arch with trees on it.
Mm-hmm.
They want to put one down by Ashland for $33 million.
Oh, they're not going to want to. They are going to put one because Oregon Department of Transportation tossed in another about $4 million to make it happen. There was another $400,000 that had been used to design it. And is that, of all the things that we look at that...
We need stuff here that isn't wildlife corridors.
Uh-huh.
How about a rehabilitation center? How about a new jail? How about, drug aversion programs?
Yeah, but you see, that costs real money. $33 million is pocket change. No, in all seriousness, I mean, I can tell you this is the way they look at it, but remember... I don't know if necessarily the wildlife overpass is a bad idea. I have a feeling a lot of people ended up, there's a lot of damage that's done each year from people hitting wildlife out there, the deer and such. You see the stories all the time. But, and I know this is probably more expensive because you can't drill underneath it. The other ones, there are six of them around the state. They have them on Highway 97. There's a few on Highway 22. And,
has anybody shown they work?
Well, I'm just giving you the source because I ended up doing this in the morning news. All I can tell you is what the state, and of course, the state of Oregon the state of Oregon has never lied to us about anything.
Never.
We know that, okay?
Never.
This, Joe, but take that into the context when I tell you that the state of Oregon reports that motorists. Encounters or smacking of the deer and the other wildlife down more than 80% when you put those corridors in. So we're going to have like a green bridge over the Interstate 5.
So stupid. Okay, well, we saw them in Canada. We couldn't believe our eyes. It was like, what the hell's going on here? I didn't even believe it. But
well,
okay,
there you go. That's it. I'm just telling you. That's what they say. That's what they say.
It's union work, union wage.
Of course.
Level wages. Hey, this is Wyden and Merkel at their best.
Yeah. Well, you know,
it's
kind of a feel good. You know, it's a feel good for the critters. And I'm sure it's about.
What about a feel good for the people?
No, that doesn't matter. The people.
Remember,
people are not part of nature. Only the critters are part of nature in the Merkley and Wyden world. The other aspect of this, though, is that I can't help but wonder when I see these sort of things if this is about part of that. Of the Wildlands Project, the rewilding of anything, of everything, and it's about. Making sure that you understand that at some point it's only going to be about
totally
the critters.
Agree.
So
I totally agree. I would love to know who the little critters are in the back room who asked for this crap.
Yeah. I appreciate the call there, Joe. I get it. I really do. 629. This is KMED.
If you've been injured in an accident, you've
been in paint on Bullock Road in Medford.
Hi, I'm Matt Stone, owner of Stone Heating and Air, and I'm on 106.3 KMED.
President Trump coming in. Hopefully we're looking at better times in 2025. One can only hope. And yet there's a part of me that wishes that he would stop. I wish he would stop licensing his image and all sorts of things. I was looking on the Salem News Channel on Salem. Of course, you know, the Hugh Hewitt folks and everything like that. They have the Trump cologne. Trump cologne, and then what did I just see on Fox here just a moment ago? The Trump $2 bills signed by Trump. Come on, can we tone the grift down just a little bit? I know that our president has the personality of a carnival barker at heart. You know, he's a great marketer. All right, there's just a part of me would just say, okay, just be president, make America great, and don't do the carnival barking stuff. That's just me. That's just me. I know big MAGA people will now be yelling at me. I'm sorry, but I just wish don't do the $2 bills. Don't do the Trump cologne. Just be a great president. Not everything needs to be done for a marketing effect, okay? It's 6:32 at KMED. EPAutos.com. It is a Wheels Up Monday, rather. We're going to talk with Eric Peters. Honda and Nissan merging? That sounds like the weirdest thing, because we were just talking about it, in what bad shape Nissan is, and yet it looks like they're going to do it. Why? We'll talk about that and more coming up. The email of the day on the Bill Myers Show, sponsored by Central Point Family Dentistry. See all they have to offer at centralpointfamilydentistry.com.
News Talk 106.3 KMED. You're waking up with the Bill Myers Show.
Outside is frightful, but the fire is so delightful.
Normally for Wheels Up Wednesday, we'd have some raucous rocker, but, it's the, a couple of days before Christmas. We'll calm it down a little bit because Eric is knuckle-busting and being skinned alive as he's trying to service his Nissan Frontier, right?
It is. It's the old model, the little compact one, and it's 23 years old, and my heater core finally gave up the ghost about a week ago. And, everybody who's been through this knows what ensues then, because the heater core is the thing that goes in first, pretty much, when the car's moving down the assembly line.
Absolutely.
Which means you have to take everything else out in order to get at the thing in order to replace it.
Replacing the heater core in my 82 Vanagon, I think it was last winter that I was doing that. Having to split apart the heater box and then get everything all gummed up again and things like that. That was the dirtiest, most disgusting job that I had done in quite some job.
It always happens in the winter. Always. It's just like your ACOs craps out on you in the height of the summer.
Yep, pretty much. And are you having any luck? Because, in some vehicles, usually the trucks have an easier time with getting to the heater core, but I guess not in this, in your particular case?
No, actually, it looks like it's not going to be all that bad. Yesterday, I went over to my buddy's shop. He's a professional mechanic, and he's got all the AC equipment. We evacuated the AC system because I have to disconnect the high-pressure lines in order to pull down the heater box. But everything is accessible pretty straightforwardly. It's astounding. Nissan designed the thing so that I take out the glove box, which is held in by 6 Phillips head screws. It comes out, and then everything else, you can see it, and it's exposed. And I think the heater box just drops down.
Oh.
And then the core is exposed, and the core looks like it just sort of slides in like a cartridge. But I haven't actually dug into it yet, so we'll see.
Yeah, my challenge with usually dealing with the heater cores is that every hose is kind of like baked to a delicate crunch at this point. Everything's stiff,
sure.
That kind of thing. And it'll be interesting. But I know that it does bring up the issue on trying to get the maximum amount of life out of those kind of things.
Yep.
Because heater cores cost a lot of money in most cars to replace. It's not that the cores themselves are expensive. They're not that bad.
No, the cores are cheap. Mine is a $60 part. But this is something that if you can't do it yourself and you have to pay a dealer mechanic or even an independent mechanic to do it, at the very minimum, it's probably going to be many hundreds of dollars and potentially even $1,000 or more.
Well, what I've been doing as part of my my regimen of maintenance, because all our vehicles are old. We have a 2006 Passat. We have a 2010 PT Cruiser and a 1982 VW Vanagon. They all work great. Nothing wrong with that. But I change the coolant every 2 years, completely change it on both of them to keep that fresh, because I got to tell you, trying to keep that all those old radiators and the old heater cores and things going and not rusting out, you got to work hard on that to do that.
Even that necessarily isn't going to solve the problem.
It's the same way.
I'm very OCD about maintenance, and I do the same thing. But, the heater core and the heater, they're relatively fragile things. If anybody out there is listening and has actually looked at one, and you think about particularly in a truck that jostles around because, it's got a pretty primitive suspension, you hit a pothole. And then over time, some of the parts, which are made of plastic, they get brittle. And no matter how well you take care of this stuff, at some point there's going to be a crack or there's going to be a failure or metal fatigue in the aluminum or the plastic or something like that.
That's true.
And bada bing, bada boom, you've got that. You'll smell that smell. And by the way, when it happened to me, it was really pretty funny because I was driving down the road with a cat in the car that I was taking to the vet. and all of a sudden the steam started coming out of the vents. You know,
oh, yeah.
It looked like a Cheech and Chong movie. You know, I had to roll down the windows with all the smoke coming out.
Oh, that's pretty wild. I've never had that happen. Usually my leaks have been the slow ones. One thing I would mention, though, is that make sure there are great differences of quality in heater cores. When I was replacing
absolutely.
The Vanagon's last year, the basic one that was going for about $70-$80 in most of the car parts stores, you'd put them in, and they were miserable heat. Miserable
yep.
heat. It just wasn't that good. And so I took it out again. And like I said, it was a nasty job still for the second time. And then I ended up getting this, there's this company over in England that that makes its entire business of making high-quality heater cores. And they cost about double what the other one is. But I'll tell you, it puts
They're
out...
They're worth every penny.
Yeah, they are worth every penny. And it just puts out, they put out tons of heat, and it just works out really, really well. And so there is a big difference. You know, we've talked about how many poor quality parts have made it into the supply chain these days for older vehicles. Got to watch that.
This is one of those penny-wise and pound-foolish things, particularly with a job like this that is such a hassle. You know, it's not like changing an air filter. You're talking about an investment usually of at least a day of your labor, you know, not even counting if you have to pay somebody else. So you don't want to ever have to do this job again. This is one of those things, I'm going to do it, and hopefully another 23 years will pass, and by that time, I doubt that I'll have this truck anymore. So,
yeah. So I mean, if you're paying someone $100-$120 or more an hour, you know, to do the shop rate, you want to make sure and use high quality parts. That is for sure.
Absolutely.
All right.
Absolutely.
Eric Peters with me this morning, 770-5633, and the phone's already here for you, Eric. We're just going to go after him and see if they have questions for you this morning.
Okay.
Hi. Good morning. Who's this? Welcome.
Good morning, guys. This is Vicky from the Apple.
Hey, Vicky. Question with Eric on cars and such. What do you say?
Well, actually, I had a comment about the heater core.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. My son's Chevy truck. So the heater core went out. Sometimes you can get to it from the engine compartment. And not always, but if you're lucky, you can. In this case, we were not able to. He was not able to. So I came out, and he started unscrewing this, taking that off, taking this off. I came out about maybe a couple of hours later, and literally it looked like crazy people came in there and stripped the whole inside. There was no seat, no steering wheel, no dash, no heater, no
yep.
radio, no nothing. And I looked at it and I thought to myself, oh, my God, are you going to be able to put this back together? And he did, and it worked fine, but it is a shock to somebody who doesn't realize the process.
Yeah, when someone tells
yep.
you that replacing the heater core is going to cost you $400 in labor, right? You know, that kind of thing.
Or $1,000 in labor, because in some cases, literally, you have to take out the entire dashboard in order to do that. It's a major job, and it's a sound policy as you're doing it to take pictures so that you remember where things went.
Yeah, I made that mistake last year, Eric, but I did get it finished out, figured out finally. Not taking pictures. Boy, that was dumb. Hey, thanks for the call there, Vicky. Let me go to line four. You're on with Eric Peters. Good morning. Hi, who's this? Welcome. Hello.
Deplorable Patrick here, Bill.
Hey, DP.
Yeah, you know, you guys, I'm riding to the rescue. I have the answer for you.
Yes.
All you got to do is get a 65 Chevy van. I had the heater core out of that thing in 10 minutes.
10 yep. minutes, huh?
You, the passenger, the person riding, the man or woman riding in the right seat, your footrest was the heater blower motor. You pull that out, it's like 5 screws. Literally out of there in 10 minutes. So that's the answer on that. But I will tell you, I had a couple buddies at work. This is a while back. And one of them was complaining, oh, I'm going to core temple or mercury temple my heater core. And the other guy would love to work on cars. He said, bring it around back and we'll go out on break and get the heater core changed for you. And I said, you guys. And so they listened to me. They listened to me. And the one that loved to work on cars, he took it home. Took him 8 hours just to get to it.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, particularly modern front-wheel drive cars, because the packaging is so tight. And in some cases, too, nowadays, they will load most of the drivetrain from underneath. So, and it's snugged up very tightly against the cowl. And accessing the parts that you need to access to make space to find what you need to get at can be medieval in terms of the torture that's involved.
Yeah, all right. Hey, thanks for that, DP. You know, he's right, though, about the 65 Chevy. I had a 65 Chevy van in Ohio for a short time during high school that I bought from a friend of mine. And everything just rusted out around it, unfortunately. But yeah, it was that easy to get to. I was going down the road one day, hit a bump, and then the gas tank flew out from
That's
underneath.
Hilarious. But you know, it's true. If you've ever, for people listening, if they've not had this experience, to get into a truck that was made in that period in the 60s and even into the 70s, mm-hmm. you often had like a metal floor, and you know that you had a fairly metal dash,
yep.
and there was almost nothing there. So when you had to get at anything, there it was. It was just a matter of breaking out a few basic hand tools, and you could remove it and replace it. Very simple.
They weren't very comfortable dashes, if you want to talk about that, or comfortable interiors, but boy, they were really good utilitarian vehicles, though, and easy to repair for that very reason, like you just talked about.
And by the way, part of the reason it's so difficult now is thanks to the government and the mandates for the airbags, you know, that have made dashes these bulbous, heavily infested with all sorts of brackets and wires and conduits and so on things.
Eric Peters with me this morning. A lot of call for you here. For you this morning, Eric. Let's go to line four. Hi, good morning. Welcome.
This is Minor Dave again. Sorry
Dave.
For the second bite. But it cost me $50 and my friend an hour and a half to change out the heater core in my pickup truck. It's a 150 Ford. And all you had to take out was the glove box.
Yeah.
And that just popped out.
But you see, that was an example. That was one of those utilitarian Fords, right? Ford. The Ford. Thank you for the call there, Dave. Let me go to another one here. Line two, you're up with Eric. It's Wheels Up Monday in this case. Hi. Who's this?
This is Troy.
Hi, Troy.
Hey, I got a car that Eric can relate to, a 78 Trans Am.
Uh-huh.
Oh, awesome. What year?
78.
Have you got the 400 or the 403?
400, 4-speed.
That's outstanding. Yeah, those are rare. That's Bill, by the way, that's the TA66. If you ever look at the hood scoop, that will tell you. And that was the high-performance version of the Pontiac 400. And that year, I think it was rated at 200 horsepower, actually about 260, according to every dyno sheet that I've ever seen of that particular engine. And those things are really desirable collectible cars now. So congratulations on that.
Hey, glad to hear that. Now, by the way, are you hanging on to that, or are you looking to sell it?
I'm definitely not selling it.
Good for you.
Just did a frame off restoration on it.
Oh, you did?
Yep.
Oh.
Yeah.
How long do you think it would take to change the heater core on that one since you took it off down to the frame?
Well, I do know that the heater core is a pain, but the blower is just as bad due to the fact you got to pull the fender just to get the fan.
Yeah, I've been there and done that with my 76, so I feel your pain.
All right.
Yeah.
Hey, thanks for the call. Enjoy seeing that. Send me a picture of that if you could, and I'll send it over to Eric, all right? Bill at BillMyersShow.com. Let me grab one more call here on Wheels Up Monday. Good morning. Hi, who's this?
Yeah, this is John.
Hey, John.
I'm glad to hear about the Nissan or your pickup, because I've been driving without a heater for a couple of years. I'm not a super mechanic, but I end up doing all my own stuff, so I use the Chilton books or whatever.
Yeah.
And it starts out, remove the seats, both, gear shift lever, steering wheel, and dash. So I said, forget it. But if I could get to it through the glove box, my God, that would be wonderful.
Well, you might be able to. You know, again, it depends on the particular make and model of truck. I lucked out in that my Frontier, which is essentially the same as the truck they used to call the hard body, you know, the Nissan hard body that goes back to the 90s, was it's a pretty simple truck. I would hate to have to try to do that job on any new or late model truck, though.
But you have a 2005, right, caller? Isn't that right?
Yes.
Yeah, that
so
might...
He's got the next generation one that's basically a mid-sized truck.
Yeah. Hmm. Well, good luck on that, and just give yourself a weekend, right?
Or you can get one of those little plug-in ceramic heaters, I guess, and, you know, just dress warmly.
It blew the fuses.
Oh, okay. Well, you know what I did one time? There was a time when I had an old 73 Volkswagen bus, and, of course, the heaters in those air-cooled ones were miserable at best.
Yep.
But I took one of those Mr. Heater buddies and screwed it onto the floor and just lit it.
Yep.
And then,
yeah.
And it actually worked really well.
Back in the day, as a factory option or a dealer installed option, I can't remember which, those old Volkswagens, those air-cooled VWs, had an accessory gas heater you could get that was plumbed into the fuel line that would compensate for the marginal heating system of the air-cooled vehicle, which would work okay if you were moving. If you were going down the road at 60 miles an hour or so, it was okay. But in stop-and-go traffic, if it was very cold outside, that little engine just didn't radiate mm-hmm. that much heat.
Yeah, we have one of those in the Volkswagen diesel, the Vanagon, because it has a diesel heater. It's an Eberspacher. I think it's the name of it, the Eberspacher. And it actually burns diesel from the fuel. And it's the relays and things are such, it's a little bit wonky at this point in time. It works, but not perfectly at this point. Yep. But I haven't had. The thing is, the stock heater is actually enough in our particular climate to do it most of the time, so it's not too bad.
Yeah, the upside with the Beetle was that the cabin of the thing was so small that if you had two people in there, body heat after about half an hour or so of driving would be enough to keep you from dying.
Very good point. The one thing about those gas heaters that I would mention, though, is that many a gas heater in an old Volkswagen set the entire car on fire, because it's the same kind of problem that you always saw with all those old Volkswagen air cools, in which the fuel hose is going to everything. You'd have these vehicles for 10, 20, 30 years or so. They get brittle and they start leaking, and then, gasoline leaking on. Now, when the diesel heater heats, it's not as, or leaks, it's not as bad. The diesel is not as big of an issue.
At least. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Indeed. All right. Hey, Eric, before we take off, I wanted to talk about one of your main articles right now, because I'm shaking my head about this one. We had talked about the rumor merger of Honda with Nissan.
Yep.
Nissan is circling the drain like you talked about. They've had a tough time for a long time. Honda is doing just fine, but they're actually talking about merging these two companies. And what the heck would Nissan bring? Well, what would Nissan bring to Honda? Because Honda is just an amazingly good. What's that now?
A lot of liabilities. There's essentially nothing right now in Nissan's product portfolio that's doing particularly well. So I don't understand why Honda would want to acquire that albatross and drape it around its neck. The reason that Honda's in good shape and that Nissan isn't is because Honda has been very reticent about embracing electrification. In fact, the only EV that they have got in their lineup is something called the Prologue, and all that is a rebadged version of the of electric Chevy, which is it, the Equinox, one of their models. The point is that they let GM eat the cost of developing this device, and then they just put their Honda badge on it as kind of an afterthought, and they've got it there. And, we're compliant. Look, we're selling an EV, but they are not bleeding themselves white the way Nissan has with things like the Leaf and the Ariya, which are not selling and have been costing the company gazoodles of money. And at the same time, Nissan's popular models are no longer popular. They've all been canceled. Models like the Maxima and the Altima, they're gone. The rumor is the Sentra is going to be gone. The Frontier now is so expensive. I love the Frontier. I've owned two. But I'm not paying $30,000+ for the thing. If at that point, why not just go ahead and get a half-ton truck? It's almost the same difference. So they're in a real pinch. And I think the only reason that Honda as a corporation would even consider making this move is because in Japan, they really have got this corporatist industrial policy thing going on. And maybe the Japanese government thinks that by combining these two and then maybe even introducing Toyota into the mix, they're going to create some kind of great colossus that's going to help them compete with China. That might be the explanation.
Is there a possibility that, instead of then buying EVs from General Motors to be compliant, we have an EV here and nobody wants them, but yet we've got them available for you. That's the compliance car. Instead, they would have a in-house version that's already been money-losing from Nissan. Nissan's already done the money-losing part of it. Maybe that's the issue here.
It could be, but why not just buy the devices? I like to use that word, by the way, for EVs, because that's what I think they are. But why not just buy surplus Leafs and Ariyas, for example, as they've been buying GM's EV, and put some Honda styling tweaks on it, call it something Honda-ish, and be done with it, instead of acquiring the entire company and all of the liabilities that come along for the ride.
Now, didn't you say in this article, which, by the way, is why would Honda buy Nissan? It's a big question ran through my head, after our conversation last week. Didn't you say there was almost something in there, though, about the fact that Nissan will help Honda electrify?
Oh, yeah, that's part of the EV Kool-Aid. That's what's astounding. Yeah, they are considering joint development of further battery-powered devices and batteries because they think you know, this is something that's kind of something that all the car industry, all the car companies around the world are thinking about. How are we going to compete with these Chinese EVs? Because the Chinese EVs are much cheaper, and that's because the Chinese government is subsidizing them and giving them all sorts of preferential treatment. They think somehow that they're going to be able to compete in the Chinese market with these EVs. It's never going to happen. The Chinese are extraordinarily protectionist, you know, to their credit, in the sense that they're trying to protect their own native industry. They're never going to allow Nissan, Honda, Toyota, or GM, or Ford, or anybody else to compete with their in-house EV makers on anything like equal terms. It's a delusion.
I imagine not, which takes me then to your Tariff Man article on EPOs.
Yeah.
What's there? Because President Trump has promised that he is going to be tariffing and tariffing bigly, you know, in 2025.
Yep, you know, it's interesting to me because what is a tariff fundamentally? It's just another name for a tax. And what do taxes do? They make things more expensive, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, for example, all of the big three, Ford, General Motors, and Stellantis, that is Ram Truck, they have operations in Mexico. So what's going to happen to the vehicles that are made and the engines that are made in Mexico? They're going to be made more expensive. It's not as though those companies are going to lower the prices of the trucks and so on that they sell here. They're just going to, you know, add the cost of doing business to the bottom line. It's going to make people's vehicles more expensive than they already are. I'd far prefer that Trump did something to end what's making things so expensive, which is a non-free market on the one hand, and all of these government regulations on the other. You know, if they, for example, got rid of all of the safety mandates, that would dramatically lower the price of vehicles. You could have access to models like that Toyota Hilux that we talk about. And that's just one of many. I like to use it as an example.
Yeah. Isn't one of the reasons why we don't have small pickup trucks here that are affordable in the United States, isn't one of the reasons the chicken tax that was put in a while back?
Oh, yeah. The chicken tax is a tariff. But there's another reason. There's something called the Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards, which I know you're familiar with. But that's basically the regulatory Bible. And, you know, it has all these things that vehicles have to comply with. And models like the Hilux don't comply. Well, neither does your two-year-old car. If you bought a two-year-old car, even if it's a top-of-the-line Mercedes, let's say, the FMVS has been updated over the course of the past couple of years. And so whatever you bought a year or two ago or 3 years ago is no longer compliant. And compliant is equated in the argot of these people with safety, even though it's absurd. You know, the idea that because your vehicle doesn't meet whatever the 2025 standards are, somehow it's become unsafe to drive. It's idiotic.
All right. So the tariff man, I'm kind of wondering where this is going to go. And this is it, because I would love to see more manufacturing in the United States. I think those are jobs that would be great to see come back.
Yep.
Here is where I have my doubts about Trump. And it's not because I don't think Trump is sincere. I think he is, you know, on these kind of issues.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, we still have the world's reserve currency.
Yep.
And a lot of people don't understand this, and I know that he's trying to still beat people above the head with the world reserve currency. If you don't use our dollar, we're going to tariff you, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know if I agree with that necessarily. When you have the world's reserve currency, generally speaking, you are exporting your inflation. It's the ability to export your inflation, and because of that, generally speaking, your domestic manufacturing will not be competitive worldwide because of your costs. That's it.
Sure. Sure. And, you know, the other factor, too, with regard to these low-cost vehicles, I think it's important to key in on. If they were available, the mere fact that they were available would have a lowering effect generally, because people would have the alternative and the dealers and the manufacturers would know that. So even though nobody would have to buy a basic simple truck like the $13,000 Hilux, the fact that they could would prompt Toyota to figure out how to make something like the Tacoma less expensive than it is.
Or for Ford, as an example, which, of course, has been the biggest truck producer in this country, along with Ram, right, I think, for the most part. A way to do it differently. Not everybody needs a three-quarter ton, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 behemoth. They just don't.
No, and it's not even just the size, but, you know, loaded up with all this stuff. You know, it's fine to have climate control AC, a 10-speaker stereo, power seats, power everything. But what if you can't afford that? You know, what if you just need a serviceable work truck?
All right. A lot to think about here going into 2025, and I wish you a Merry Christmas for sure, Eric. Before we take off, what is the gift in your driveway recently, huh? What's up?
Oh, well, we're going to talk about, I guess, on our next episode, we'll talk about the Camry Hybrid that I've got, which is, you know, it's interesting on a number of levels. You know, the first is that it's kind of a compliance car in the sense that the only reason Toyota has turned the Camry into a mandatory hybrid, it used to be optional. You used to be able to get it with a regular four-cylinder engine, you could get it with a V6. And if you wanted, you could get it with a hybrid drivetrain. But now they've turned it exclusively into a hybrid, and the reason for that is because of these federal mandates that have required every car company to meet a almost 50 mile per gallon standard. And the only way they can do that is with these hybrid powertrains, and that's why you're seeing them proliferate. Now, the downside is, yeah, it gets 50 miles per gallon, but it costs a couple thousand dollars more than it used to, plus you don't have the option of choosing something else, which you ought to have a right to as an American, ostensibly, living in a so-called free society. Maybe you don't want a hybrid for whatever reason. Maybe you just want a standard four-cylinder.
Yeah, but you know, the part that is really difficult, and I'm hoping that that our favorite orange man can actually do something about the regulatory apparatus. There is almost nothing that the federal government does not touch and regulate to the nth degree in almost every aspect of our lives. And will we ever be the land of the free again as long as that is happening? I don't think so.
I don't think so. And, you know, but Trump could make a very solid case, I think, for ending the federal mandatory MPG standards. How is that any business of the government? If you want to buy a vehicle that gets 10 miles per gallon, why shouldn't that be your right? You know, and if the manufacturers want to make vehicles like that available and there's a market for it, so be it. You're paying for it. You're paying for the vehicle. You're paying for the gas. And at the same time, you know, if efficient vehicles are desirable, well, the market's going to provide that too.
Yeah, but as long as you have people like, you know, Merkley and Wyden and various others, and even a lot of Republicans that will say this, that are talking about climate chaos, yeah, that's baked in the cake. You know that.
Well, and that's a lot of nonsense too. And Trump really does need to challenge that. You know, as an aside, I won't go off on a rant about this, but one of the reasons that I'm very ambivalent about Elon Musk is he favors carbon taxes, and he continues to sort of back the BS about the climate change thereby.
And besides, though, the fact that he's now talking about getting rid of the electric car mandates after, like we mentioned last week on Wednesday's show, about the fact that he built his entire empire on the back of the government grift with the taxes.
Sure,
So I don't trust this guy, and yet all of corporate America is naturally buddying up to Donald Trump because they're hoping to have some influence, and it seems to work. So we'll see.
Well, I mean, it's just like the scene where, you know, Michael becomes the new Don, right? And everybody comes in to kiss the ring of the new Godfather.
And it is so true. The new Don. You're absolutely right. Godfather Part 2. Godfather Part 2. Good stuff there. By the way, one of my favorite movies, too, by the way.
One of the best movies ever made.
Yep, indeed. 704. Eric, Merry Christmas. Be well, and good luck on the job on your frontier. That's going to be
a
tough one.
I'll keep you posted, and I'll send you some pictures of the job in process.
I appreciate that. Thanks, Eric. We'll see you next year, okay?
Thanks, Bill.
Eric Peters, epautos.com. It's 4 minutes after 7. This is KMED, KMED HD1, Eagle Point, Medford, KBXG, Grants Pass. The Bill Myers Show podcast is sponsored by Clouser Drilling. They've been leading the way in Southern Oregon well drilling for over 50 years. Find out more about them at clouserdrilling.com.
Here's Bill Myers.
Mr. Outdoors is here. Greg Roberts, good to talk with you here this morning, Greg. And now that we're within that 48 hours of the big travel to grandmother's or grandfather's house or just heading out, are we going to see a whole bunch of snow and lowering snow levels? Or what are we thinking here now that we're getting closer? Because the way it looks on Friday is often the way it's not looking Monday, just the way it goes, right?
Yeah, and, you know, sometimes you're watching things happen that you're still waiting to see how the timing of this is all going to play out. Well, unfortunately for us, for down here in the valleys for a white Christmas, once we hit the 48-hour window this morning and we could start using shorter-range deterministic models like HRRR and SREF, and then taking a look at a thing called MOS guidance, which most forecasters are going to take a look at, especially the TV variety, because it essentially tells you what to expect, you know, so you can set your forecast up. Like whoever it was we just listened to from KOBI, guarantee you MOS guidance is a huge part of how they're putting their forecast.
By the way, what is MOS? Is that like a something service, or what does that mean?
No, it's basically... I'm going to actually pull this
because I was thinking MOS like, you know,
it stands, you know, And of course, I'm doing this and I'm trying to figure out.
That's okay. I didn't mean to get you off in the weeds.
I'm trying to remember what the MOS forecast model.
I don't mean to get you off in the weeds. It's okay.
Okay, here it is. It's model output statistics. So what it does, and I just, I blanked it because I just say it's MOS. Model output statistics. So what it's going to do, it's a computer program that essentially it'll collect all the data from all the various forecast models. That's going to include the two mains, the European, the GFS. Then it's going to include secondaries like ICON, GEM. It's going to throw all of that into the computer, basically, and say, okay, this one sees this, this one sees this.
I never realized there were so many different weather systems all combining out there to try to determine where it's going. I didn't know that, really.
Yeah, there is, and there's a lot of different methodology, and if you're going to look beyond just MOS guidance, if you're going to start looking at, even things far more likely, the two that are most frequently going to be used are the European and the GFS, because those are kind of, you've got the two superior ones that are in use all around the globe. And this tends to be the modeling that your degreed meteorologists definitely use far more. And then it kind of becomes a thing of, well, which one historically has been more accurate? And it's kind of interesting, typically at different times of the years, or different times of the year. Jeez, I'm having a hard time today. Anyway, European...
Hey, there's not enough coffee in my world right now, Greg. I'm with you,
exactly,
okay? I get it.
And actually, I'm trying a brand new coffee, a gift from a friend of mine that he said perfect for hockey season. It's Tim Hortons coffee from up in Canada.
Oh.
And, of course, it's hockey season. I'm trying it for the first time, and I got to admit, it's good. I just haven't had enough of it.
All right. Now, as far as these different models, though... is anybody talking in your weather world? By the way, Greg Roberts is with me once again, RogueWeather.com. I was reading something. I go through a lot of financial blogs because I just find the money people interesting, as where they're going to push the money to do certain things. Nothing happens until someone's pushing funding to it. And I was reading about talks of quantum computing, and they were saying that it would revolutionize the weather forecasting era, because the current type of computers that we have, which is a linear computer with ones and zeros, et cetera, the binary type computers, are limited on what they are able to do and how many calculations and the way that they calculate, and that quantum computing is going to be the way of the future on that. Are they discussing that about weather? Because that's one of the issues with weather. Because weather is chaos. It's chaos everywhere. It's chaos theory all the time,
Well, and it's kind of the wheels grind slowly, and sometimes in some things they grind more slowly than others. Meteorology, firefighting world, for example. Mm-hmm. But the other part of the problem is there is an immense field of data that you've got to... basically retool and get set for these new, the quantum side of things with its ability to process so much more, so much faster.
Well, I wonder if there's anything to the, even when they talk about the butterfly effect, in which a butterfly flaps the wings and then, and then all of a sudden the hurricane starts days later, that kind of thing.
Right. The butterfly effect, and we've talked about this, that is, when you look at how the atmosphere operates, the butterfly effect is absolutely true. And this is one of the big challenges that you get in trying to forecast. There are so many X factors that enter into it anywhere, but especially here, Southern Oregon, Northern California, our microclimate zones are in the thousands.
Other forecasters have told me that this area is actually quite a challenge to do reasonable forecasting. It's just hard.
The only place more difficult is southeastern Alaska.
Mm-hmm. Lots of microclimates.
In the continental, in the United States, I started to say continental, and southeastern Alaska, it would be part of the continental U.S., but it's, we've got lower 48, we've got Alaska, and we've got Hawaii, and that southeastern coast of Alaska is by far the toughest one to forecast within the United States, but we're number two.
Number two. Now, what about the Midwest in those areas, like when I was working at KFGO in Fargo, back in the late 90s and such, and they had three staff meteorologists on a radio station because the weather was so key in that particular area. And I thought maybe it's not that hard to forecast because you just say, okay, the storm's coming, you're going to die. You know, that kind of thing is all you had to do, was say.
Yeah, here's the thing. I envy them their ability to watch things developing out here, to watch things developing over the Rockies, because by the time it reaches Fargo, North Dakota, you've got a really good idea of what's going to wind up happening.
Yeah.
The reason for three staff meteorologists is so that when you're getting severe weather outbreaks, and in this case, more specifically tornadoes, but in the winter it could be blizzards, if you've got three, you're guaranteed 24-hour coverage.
And we did. We had that. And you needed that because the weather was honestly routinely killing people. That's the way it worked out there in the Midwest.
Yep.
The storms there in Fargo, Moorhead, and those areas, and just routinely killing people, whether it's flooding, whether it was the snow, the blizzards and such. And so it was a big deal. Very important for people. Really was.
Yeah, right. And that's why in Fargo, even in smaller towns, you will have the staff meteorologist with the TV and radio stations that where you might get those people being eliminated first in other parts of the country with budget cut times.
Uh-huh.
They'll be the last ones back there in those parts of the world. And then for down in Florida, because of hurricanes, that's a big essential to keep their staff meteorologists, because like you said, the weather can and will kill people. And one of my favorite things that I heard from Texas all the way to North Dakota was this one: you're a barbed wire fence from hell in the summer, and you're a barbed wire fence from the North Pole in the winter.
Yeah, that's about it too. That's so true. So, Greg, are we going to see White Christmas after all this? I know I kind of got you off in the weeds, my apologies, but I kind of like to hear how they come up with this kind of stuff and what is developing.
Yeah, I was building to that. Mm-hmm. We do have Arctic air that's coming in. I put a post up on Rogue Weather last night about that. That is going to arrive. That is the reason that snow levels this morning that are running up around 7,000 feet are going to be down somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000 feet by the time we reach tomorrow afternoon, which is why there's going to be impact on travel. Right now, it doesn't look anything severe, but at this time of the year, and especially with all the people coming up from the south and just all the people we have here in general who can't handle driving on any snow and ice, say Siskiyou Summit around Mount Shasta, any of that's going to be an impact. So, yes, there is going to be some. Is it major to the point where it starts closing things down? Not even.
Okay.
The wind side of it is going to be, right now, honestly, far more significant.
Boy, I saw you do a post over the weekend that the winds peaked out at over 50 miles an hour at the airport here in town.
Yeah. Our biggest gust that we hit was 58 miles an hour.
Wow.
So it was kind of funny because the night before, we might see 45, and especially down around Ashland, Talent. Nope, that wound up being a widespread thing. Saturday morning, I had to go pick up a friend of mine, give him a ride, and he lives over there in East Medford. I'm not going to say close to you, but also not that far away, and driving over to get him, I was pretty amazed at how much debris there was down all over the place.
Oh, we always get amazing winds in our neighborhood by Foothill. Yeah. We're not too far from Foothill. I think it's because it just whips around the mountain, the Roxy Ann,
you know. Those East Hills in Medford and along Foothill Road and to the east of it, you get that wind funnel effect that winds just kind of curl around Baldy and just follow terrain, and it just goes right up all the way to Roxy Ann and then heads out to the north, and then the valley opens up and the winds kind of lose the channeling effect. but there probably was also some of that. So if the airport was peaking at 58 miles an hour, it wouldn't surprise me if those locations, east side of Medford and especially east of Foothill up there in the hills on Roxy Ann, if they weren't seeing higher winds than that.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me at all. What do you think then about the chances for more heavy snow in the pass levels, also Ashland, Shasta, 140. How are they looking? Yeah. Doesn't sound like there's going to be any problem getting out to the coast over the next few days, right?
Right. And honestly, though, what we miss for Wednesday morning, for Christmas morning, and having the chance for a white Christmas, because now to absolutely define that, even though we do have the SREF showing some ongoing shower activity still over Jackson and Josephine counties, meaning the valley areas, and even though temperatures would be enough to support snow, it's looking far more like we'll just see some snowflakes coming out of the skies rather than any kind of accumulation, because there just isn't going to be enough moisture available to get the kind of snowfall rate that we need to get to an accumulation.
So drying out, even though we're going to have some rain and snow possibility, overall drier.
Right. And the other thing, the MOS, and you're probably going to see, and especially, again, I forget who it is. I know it's not Kevin Lawless doing the top of the hour forecast from KOBI at this time of the day. They're going to be talking about fog on Christmas morning, because the MOS guidance, especially in Jackson County, where it is expected we're going to have clearer skies. Josephine County right now, per the MOS, is definitely looking better for the chances of showers on Christmas morning that may potentially put snowflakes in the air. And Jackson County, MOS is showing it as fog up until about 1 p.m. in the afternoon, and then about 1 p.m. in the afternoon on Christmas Day, here comes the next batch of rain and snow, and that looks far more significant in terms of amount of snow it's going to put down than what we're expecting to see Christmas Eve night into Christmas morning. And I'm looking at the latest, and Medford National Weather Service, they're forecasting a snow level around 4,000 to 5,000 feet, which right now, everything I saw looking at it this morning when I was running models, I'm going to say it's far more likely it's going to be that 4,000 foot.
Okay.
Could even be lower, but they're projecting 12 to 18 inches from Wednesday night through Thursday night. So 12 to 18 inches for the Cascades. It looks like probably 6 to 12 for the Siskiyous, maybe a bit higher for Mount Ashland ski area. But you get down around Mount Shasta, and the really interesting thing is they're showing less than an inch at Mount Shasta City and I-5, but right up on Mount Shasta itself, when you start gaining elevation, this is where you get another area where you could be looking at that 12 to 18 inch, maybe more range. All areas east of the Cascades definitely will see some snow. It looks like the majority of it is going to be the 1 to 2 inch range, except northern Klamath County and the Highway 97 corridor. So if you're going to try and get over to Bend, you will definitely hit heavier snow from Chemult north towards Lapine, and looking somewhere in the 4 to 8 inches, just by what I can see from Medford National Weather Service output. The model runs I was doing this morning all back that up. All of them had far more significant snow coming in for Wednesday night and in through Thursday than anything ahead of Christmas. But again, this is going to continue. Rain and snow will continue pretty much on a regular interval, the way it's stacking up right now, from now basically through New Year's. So
okay.
When people would be more likely to be returning home because of how New Year's lands this year, being on a Wednesday, that following weekend, because back to school Monday, as I call it, coming out of Christmas vacation, is the 6th. Looks like we're going to continue to see rain and snow coming all the way through the 2nd, and then a little bit of a window opens up, and it looks like we may have drier conditions now for that first weekend of January, when, again, it's another big travel period for people.
All right, Greg. Hey, I appreciate that. Got a call for you, I think, there. Hi, good morning. You're on with Greg. Who's this?
Good morning, boys. This is Jim from Jacksonville.
Yeah, Jim.
Hey, Greg, I this is a little bit sideways, but I missed your results of your elk hunt this year. You guys were going to go out and did you tag an elk, or is this a bad
No, the elk we were chasing are all still, you know, very much alive, and now they've moved into where they spend their winters, which, you know, the good news for the elk is it's very locked up, very private, and they usually don't get anybody in there disturbing them. So the elk we were chasing, especially the big bull, gave us the slip, and, you know, they definitely will live another day. That big bull is absolutely lived to keep passing his genes on, unless, you know, he encounters a cougar or something, you know, unexpected happens to him. He'll likely still be very much alive next year when the hunting seasons come around, because just by what we see looking at him in the game cam photos, he looks to be somewhere around 5 to 6 years old. So he's still in the prime of his life, but we're going to start hitting the decline period for him here pretty quickly.
Yeah, I really appreciate that information, and leaving him in the gene pool is a good idea. Thank you for all of your help this year, Greg, and Bill, also, you have a nice day off. Appreciate that.
Oh, hey, really appreciate that, Jim.
Yeah,
thank you for the call.
And he's saying, have a nice day off. Well, especially the way I live my life, there really is no such thing as a true day off. You know, you might have days where you're less focused because maybe the weather's not as crazy, but you're still... I mean, the routine for me is the routine. I'm getting up every morning. I'm taking a look at what's going on, and we have to be ready for the fact that things could go sideways at about any point. And that may happen on Christmas. That may happen on Thanksgiving, you know. But, heck, I go back to the days when I was doing fire and EMS, and you were always...
you're always on call. Just the way it goes, okay?
Yeah.
And let's grab another one here. Hi, you're on with Greg. Good morning. Who's this?
Good morning, it's Peter. I was wondering if you can tell me, based on the idea that the progeny of that big bull, it would seem to me, with all the academics that set policy, that there would be a restriction on taking the best of the bucks.
There's been a lot of conversation in the hunting world about that, hasn't there?
There has. And when they opened up spikes to be legal for harvest in the Western Oregon deer rifle season, there was some controversy about that. But so far to this point, that has not proven to have had a dramatic decrease in the number of bucks that we're seeing. In fact, the last buck that I saw while I was out in the woods was a spike. So spikes are escaping. We're not seeing an appreciable huge rise in success numbers for hunters, either checked in the field by OSP or ODF&W or reporting online. There just hasn't been that big dramatic spike that a lot of people figured would happen when spikes became legal. They can and they do, especially in Eastern Oregon and on the coastal seasons. They will restrict the hunting to spike bulls only, mm-hmm. because they want those bigger herd bulls to be able to escape and carry on the genes. I haven't seen them do that down here in Southern Oregon, like, ever. I can't remember it in my lifetime. They are issuing more over-the-counter damage tags now for a season that runs from August 1st to March 31st the next year, but it is all entirely up to the hunter to find the private property to gain access to go out and do that hunt. ODF&W is not taking damage reports from people and then sending hunters out anymore. They leave that up to the hunters to do. And that tag down here is designed to be far more focused at taking out cows and also the younger the calves.
All right. Very good. Hey, really appreciate the call, caller there. And final question I have for you. What's your thought about our $38 million wildlife overpass over there at Milepost 1.7 that's about to be put in or will be put in now that it's been announced with the Grand Stream funding? I don't think it's the worst idea that I've seen when it comes to getting the animals over the interstate without getting whacked, and probably save a lot of drivers some trouble and potential danger too.
Well,
but
yeah, it definitely will reduce human trauma. It definitely reduces wildlife deaths. It's not like this is an untried idea.
Mm-hmm.
It's about time they're finally doing it over here, because when you jump on Highway 97 and you're taking off from 138, by the time you hit Bend, you will have gone over four of those.
Right.
And they work.
And there's a bunch. There's a couple of them on Highway 22, from what I recall.
Yes. And it's a big proven success record. And I'm thrilled to death that they got a brain and decided to put one in on I-5, because it's very well known that the Siskiyou Pass area on I-5 is a major wildlife crossing point, because it is the direct route for wildlife to move from the Cascades to the Siskiyous and then eventually the Coast Range. And I've been waiting for them to do this from the time we realized how successful they truly were. You know, the mule deer population east of the Cascades continues to go down at a pretty alarming rate.
Now, do you think that when they put this in, though, in all honesty, will they camera that up so that people can kind of see the, you know, the where, you know, what kind of wildlife is traveling over it from time to time?
Because they'll camera it up, and I'm not sure how much they make that publicly accessible, so you could sit and watch it in real time, quote unquote.
Yeah.
But they do put cameras in, so ODF&W, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, all the wildlife agencies will have access to see exactly what is coming through and utilizing that. And, you know, again, they work. They know it works, because you immediately get a reduction in wildlife versus vehicle collisions. And, you know, you just – it you see – the wildlife, when they realize that's there, they definitely flow in.
Yeah, they'll go there instead of over the road.
Yep.
That's fine. Now, you are not allowed to set up your hunting.
No, definitely
okay.
not.
And just kind of thinking, right?
Safety zone.
All right. No hunting zone. Got it. Okay. That would make sense.
But I'm just going to say, now, of course, on 97, the other thing that they've done, and you will see this, they have put up miles and miles of real high fencing along 97 to discourage deer and elk from using any other point other than the wildlife, in those cases, the underpasses, and the deer and the elk and everything else has gotten the message. They use them.
All right. Now, this may be a really dumb question, because I'm not really all that experienced with these, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a possibility that even though humans won't be hunting on the you know, the overpass, you're not allowed to do that, right? That'd be poaching, et cetera, et cetera. Do the predators hang out on those areas and wait?
Well, we know the predators use them.
Uh-huh.
We've already seen cougars, wolves. I mean, basically every predator you can think of in Oregon has popped up in the cameras on the wildlife underpass.
Yeah, but I would just wonder if a predator would then look at this as shooting fish or deer or anything in a barrel.
They don't seem to, though. Uh-huh. I'm not seeing anywhere that anybody's documenting natural predation occurring in higher instances around these.
Okay, all right. Just thought I'd ask. And, have that assuaged then. Hey, have a wonderful weekend. I will catch you a week from Friday as we get into the new year, and we'll have a lot to talk about, I'm sure, there, Greg. Okay?
Yes,
thanks.
We will. And, the last thing I definitely wanted to say before we get out of here, Mount Ashland is still sticking to aerial reopening to everybody on Wednesday, on Christmas Day. So, great news. The damage that looked really bad in that photo they made public did not appear to seriously damage that lift tower.
Good.
Which was great news. And they are stating Ariel will return on Christmas Day. So excellent news there. And then the last thing I want to say, again, thanks to everybody who listens. Had it happen again in the store yesterday. I was in Winco grabbing some stuff for dinner last night and had a couple people tell me how much they enjoy listening to you and I do what we do on the radio.
That's good.
And we deeply, Bill and I both, deeply appreciate every single one of you listening to us right now. We truly do. And wish everybody a truly Merry Christmas.
All right. Merry Christmas to you, Greg. Greg Roberts at Rogue Weather. Kind of an extended one. I wanted to find out a little bit more, though, what the actual computers were. That's why I got into that. I got a little bit off into the weeds there. But every now and then, I just know nothing about this. But I was reading about the quantum conversations and everything else. Thank you, Greg. Greg Roberts over at RogueWeather.com. It is 7:42 at KMED. We're going to check the rest of the news here in just a moment. And by the way, Oregon Truck and Auto Authority on Airway Drive in Medford is the sponsor of the Outdoor Report. We tend to do it every Friday in this particular case, Monday before the big holidays are coming up. Oregon Truck and Auto Authority. Now then, news is coming up. We have some open phones. We're going to do a Diner 62 quiz. We got Dr. Powers talking about history. The Christmas history in the Rogue Valley. Going to be very nice. Looking forward to it.
As 2025 approaches, Dusty's Transmissions extends heartfelt
Patriot Electric. And to all, a good night.
You're hearing the Bill Myers Show on 106.3 KMED.
Bob writes me this morning saying, Bob, what happened with the cameras in the restroom story out of Grants Pass? I had that. I talked about that when I first came on this morning, Bob. I appreciate you asking me again. I ended up talking with a city official, Bradley, who ended up being in charge of facilities. And he says there's absolutely no truth to any talk about those little boxes inside those Portland Loo style. These are the bathrooms that are over the public restrooms that are where the raving lunatic, drug-addicted homeless like to cause all sorts of mayhem. It's why they end up having these kind of stainless steel, easier to clean out kind of places, kind of indestructible loos, as they call them. And he still insists that they are infrared, infrared sensors to turn on lights and turn on the blue lights, especially the blue lights that keep you from wanting to shoot up inside there. And then other people who I think may have been behind some of those anonymous letters that were going out about this, writing me over the weekend, like I mentioned, saying things like, well, I went in there and they didn't turn on and off and yada, yada, yada. And they're still insisting that they're cameras. The city insists that they are not. There are people who are insisting that they are. Without me getting into that box, I probably couldn't really say one way or the other. I will tend to err on the city of Grants Pass being correct on this one and other people being incorrect or not being able to really grab it. The other thing I would add is that they would say that you could put some toilet paper on it and then it wouldn't turn on or wouldn't stay off or things would stay on. There are delays that are set up on all of these things. And once once they turn on, maybe they're on for 10 or 15 minutes. I don't know how that works. But I got to tell you, given the problems that we've had it with the drug-addicted raving lunatics that have been running our streets and ruining bathrooms and such like that, there's a part of me that almost hopes that they do have a camera or two in there to take note of who's in there so that when there is a problem, they can go back and figure out who's causing their trouble. Now, I would imagine there is a way to do a headshot where you were to take a view of the restroom without violating anyone's personal biological processes, right? You know, those kind of things. Maybe there's a way to do that. I know state statute may not permit that. But I got to tell you, we're at this point with so much damage. I don't think that we have a duty to provide shooting galleries for the homeless here in Southern Oregon. We just don't. For the drug addicts, we can't. We can't do that. And maybe there's the other theory that I may have on this is that it's supposed to look like a camera and maybe freak some of the people out. Maybe that's part of it. It could be kind of a decoy of sorts. So the city tells me, the person who answered the phone said it was nonsense, and then the facilities manager, Bradley, that I ended up talking to, said absolutely no truth to this. No cameras in there, that they are infrared sensors. That's all I can tell you, all right? That's what we know, okay? Carrie writes me this morning, Bill, heater core. I'm changing the heater core in a 1996 Corvette. 2 days of standing on my head. Oh, man. Man, you have my sympathy. That's a very difficult car to service, just period, right? Any of those kind of more exotic cars, that's for sure. Carrie, salute off to you, okay? There we go. We'll catch up on the rest of the news here in just a moment. Diner 62 quiz. I think we'll do that in just a moment, too. 770-563-3770-KMED. If you have won this in the last 60 days, you can win it next. Little ho, 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 happy Christmas for you.
Discover exceptional senior living at Prestige Care Senior Living, where comfort meets care. Visit PrestigeCare.com.
Find gifts for everyone on your list for less at Coastal.
Hi, I'm Corey with Patriot Electric, and I'm on KMED.
Appreciate you being here for the Diner 62 Real American Quiz. By the way, Randy wishes everybody, by the way, Randy and the crew from D62, saying Merry Christmas. Now, they'll be closed for Christmas, but through the holidays, all those amazing specials are still there. Hot open-faced sandwiches like the pot roast sandwich with mashed potatoes and brown gravy, or the hot turkey sandwich with tomatoes gravy and cranberry sauce. Mm-mm-mm. By the way, Friday of this week, still Clam Chowder Friday, even in the holidays, and a couple of pork chops and eggs or an 8-ounce New York steak and eggs on special right now on the weekends. All right, let me go to, we got Jerry. Jerry, how you doing this morning? Welcome.
Hey, good. Good morning.
Jerry, today it was, it was today in history, December 23rd of 1867, Madam C.J. Walker is born, okay? She was a future entrepreneur, philanthropist, self-made millionaire, Madam C.J. Walker, born Sarah Breedlove in Delta, Louisiana. Walker's parents and sharecroppers who had been enslaved died when she was 11. Walker eventually left Louisiana, spent her 20s in St. Louis, Missouri. By the time of her death at the age of 51 in 1919, Walker's business was producing an annual revenue of $500,000, $500,000 in 1919. That was real money then, okay? And she had amassed a large real estate portfolio, including the mansion Villa Loaro in Westchester County, New York, and a palatial townhome in Harlem. Now, according to the history, folks, Walker is now considered to be the first female millionaire in America, Jerry. What product or service started and built her empire? What made her a millionaire in 1919? Was it A, Scotch whiskey? Was it B, hair tonic? Was it C, jams and jellies? Was it D, gardening tools? Or was it E, dry cleaning? It's one of those five. What do you think?
I'm thinking it was the hair tonic.
You're thinking it's hair tonic? Of all the things you make $1 million on, hair tonic? Seriously?
I think I remember this quiz, actually.
Yeah, you're right.
You're a winner!
You got it. You know, sometimes having a little bit of trivial knowledge is good. Isn't it, Jerry? Worked out pretty well. And she was working as a laundress for about $1 a day to support herself and her daughter. She developed a hair loss problem, and then Walker began using products produced by the black hair care entrepreneur, Annie Turnbow Malone. She found success, inspired to create her own line of hair care products. The Madam C.J. Walker Manufacturing Company started selling Madam C.J. Walker's Wonderful Hair Grower in 1906 using sulfur, copper sulfate, beeswax, petrolatum, which I think is like petroleum jelly, coconut oil, and a violet extract perfume. Her company at its peak would go on to employ over 25,000 women. It's an interesting story. And they nicknamed them the Walker agents, who made house visits across the United States and the Caribbean. And by the time she died in 1919, Walker's business producing an annual revenue of over a half million. And like I said, that large real estate. She was the first one, first female millionaire. Pretty interesting stuff. And we're going to send you to Diner 62. Hang on. We'll get you all set up. Okay. Thanks, Jerry. 757.
We've all done it. You approach your vehicle and see a scratch or a ding. Grim.
To mind. Incogni.com.
Good morning. This is News Talk 106.3 KMED, and you're waking up with the Bill Myers Show.
Town Hall News is coming out here in just a moment. By the way, I wanted to mention, wanted to thank the folks at Clouser Drilling. Clouser Drilling, the sponsor of Mannheim Steamrollers and American Christmas on KBXG, the jukebox, which is going to start tomorrow morning, 9 o'clock. And on KMED's Fontana Roofing. KMED Fontana Roofing is the sponsor of that, and we really appreciate that. And it's one time of year that... You guys got to face the fact of the matter that the B, C, and D teams are going to be in the talk radio world tomorrow. That's just the way it goes, all right? Because all the main hosts, they're taking the day off for the most part, or else they're going to do a best of. And it's kind of funny when you hear them doing best ofs, and it's a there's an interview of someone that's talking about, well, if Donald Trump wins, sometimes it's just better just to... What is it? Either fish or cut bait. We'll cut bait tomorrow here, but then things are back to normal. The Hugh Hewitt Show filling in for me through the next week or so, and I'll be back on the 2nd after New Year's, okay? But I appreciate your listenership, and we also thank Clouser and also Fontana Roofing for the sponsor of An American Christmas. All right, good stuff. It's a couple minutes after 8. KMED, KMED, HD1, Eagle Point, Medford, KPXG, Grants Pass. We're going to be talking about the history of Christmas in the Rogue Valley, what a typical Christmas was like back in the day. It's a little bit different from our waiting for the Amazon truck in or going over to the malls and all of the other stores. But we'll have that coming up, along with your calls and opinion and some more emails of the day before we take off.
Lose your car key or remote.